to the third case. International Financial Services versus Chroma Technologies, Canada. Mr. Cordray?
Mr. Dunn.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry, Mr. Dunn.
No relation, however. Good morning. May it please the court.
Prior case.
Yes. I represent Aquaflex, Inc., which is formerly known as Chroma Technologies Canada, Inc., and for the purpose of the argument, I'll just refer to Canada instead of using the new name. Canada appeals from a verdict in excess of $1 million based on a breach of contract to which neither it nor the plaintiff was a party. The actual parties were not present at the trial. The contract was between a Texas corporation called Label Tech Corp. and Diddy Web Press to build a commercial printing press. The plaintiff financed Label Tech's acquisition of the press.
Is the reason this is a 54B, right?
Yes, this came up on a 54B.
And it wasn't clear why, but let me just throw my own surmise out and tell me whether it's right or wrong. Was this the last minute before Judge Kaur that was not in bankruptcy or dismissed?
Yeah, so the sort of the last man standing.
Okay.
There were two subsidiaries, actually. One was voluntarily dismissed on the eve of trial. It's not really clear that was reflected anywhere, but I think everybody represented this court would agree that that happened.
And as I understand it, that the two that were pending in bankruptcy, there would have been this thing would have just been out in suspension somewhere until that was resolved. Therefore, the case wouldn't have been final. That's why it needed 54B.
When the court first issued or asked for our opinion, there were a couple of unincorporated entities out there, which I don't believe were cleared up by the record. But ultimately, I think we came down to, yes, the two Diddy entities are still in bankruptcy out in Kansas. And that's why it had to come up as a 54B.
Because it couldn't be final until that was resolved, and whether or not they're, I don't know what.
But I think there's some question as to that ultimately, but my impression was everybody decided to be on the safe side. And
well, he didn't say why. That's why I wanted to make sure there's some reason we can at least fill in order to say why we have jurisdiction.
Right. I think that's the belt and suspenders to the jurisdiction. It wasn't clear, I think, on the law that the bankruptcy stay actually didn't render it a final judgment. And the district court clearly thought it was a final judgment. I mean, it said it was final. But this court, I think, raised questions. It was never really resolved, but everyone agreed that if we did 54B, that would solve the whole jurisdictional problem.
Okay.
Today, I'd like to follow the court's example in CLAN Services versus PepperSource and propose that we just grasp the nettle of this case to proceed right to the equitable fraud prong of Illinois doctrine for piercing the corporate veil. And that's because it would moot the need to argue for reversal based on a right to a jury trial or the burden of proof on the instruction. Illinois is a particularly strict jurisdiction with respect to disregarding corporate entities. This court pointed out in Chicago Florsheim's Shoe Store Company that separate identification is the rule to which the piercing is the stringently applied exception. And indeed, the briefing reveals no appellate decisions either in this circuit or in the Illinois courts on facts remotely similar to these in which piercing was permitted either by the trial court or by the appellate court on review. Illinois has a two-part test. The first is that the corporation must be a sham, so that it has no separate personality at all. The point I would like to go to is the second part of the test, which is the sham has to be manipulated in order to cause an equitable fraud. This court in CLAN Services describes the burden of proof as follows. There must be an intentional scheme to squirrel assets into a liability-free corporation while heaping liabilities upon an asset-free corporation. Exactly the opposite happened in this case. It was stipulated going in that Diddy Corporation sold Canada in September 2000 to raise cash to fund operations.
I know you're going to cover the jury issue, but just when you're referring to this, where did the $7 million go?
The $7 million went all right into the Diddy entities. I believe the stipulated facts say that it was used to fund operations. Now, where it went into bankruptcy, that I don't know.
No, I mean, I guess we're calling it Canada, when Canada went north, it did that for, or whoever bought it, I don't know who bought it, that was $7 million for a sale of the stock, right?
Right.
And so whatever liabilities it had went with it.
Right.
But the $7 million is what it is an issue, and there's whatever the argument is, that I guess the other side says, well, that $7 million, some went here, some went there, and it was this. In other words, it wasn't clear that the $7 million was cash that was used, I would assume, to, was it TMB? What's the name of these companies? Diddy?
Diddy Corporation and Diddy Web.
Okay. So these are, supposedly it went in there for operations, obviously not for the printer, but nevertheless, supposedly to keep these companies on their feet. They're the ones that were actually building the printer, right?
Right. Chromos Technologies had nothing to do with building this press.
Okay.
In essence, what Diddy did was maximize their liquid assets by converting those closely held shares into cash. And the testimony was unrebutted that cash was used to fund the operations. And indeed, I think there were audited financials pointed later on introduced. There's something like $750,000 of inventory was purchased, and services were purchased and earmarked for this particular press. Of course, there were other presses that were being manufactured at the same time. Scientific Games had an even larger press that was being manufactured and which was completed.
Had that $7 million been misused or done something different than what you say it was, could that have been a basis for piercing the corporate veil?
It would have been a basis for piercing the corporate veil as to, say, Diddy's shareholders, Mr. Diddy, or maybe to the parent, or maybe to another affiliate.
You mean the money went there?
Right, but what we have here is you're trying to pierce the veil with respect to the company which actually injected the cash in. So you're really trying to double dip. You're trying to say, I want the $7 million that your new ownership put in, and then I want another million to make up for what the Diddy guys might have done on their own.
Well, I guess in reading the brief, I think they at least dispute the fact that that's what happened to the $7 million. Isn't that right?
I didn't see any evidence in the record that the money went anywhere else, and indeed it was, I believe, stipulated in the record that the money was used to fund operations. In fact, it's the last stipulation in Exhibit 1. The sale of CTI and CTC were intended to raise cash for Diddy to continue to operate. That was a stipulated fact. There was no evidence to the contrary. There's no evidence, certainly, that my client never got anything out of the deal except this lawsuit.
So aside from the money, what would be then the basis for piercing the corporate veil?
Well, there really isn't any in this case. If you look at what this company, or what this court said in CM Corp, where it upheld the reversal of the jury verdict, very more egregious facts in here. And said, well, if the assets were raided by the defendant, that would be one thing. If a fraud was perpetrated to make the company insolvent, that would be something else. But they said, without such evidence, there is simply no basis for a jury could find that a wrong had been committed. And I would suggest this case is just like the Kelsey, Axel, and Brake case and the Wallen case, which are cited in our briefs, where the courts say, well, there's no dissipation of funds for the benefit of the defendant. Clearly none here. The defendant was the one putting the funds in. There was no facade to avoid rightful responsibility. That's a burden of proof on the plaintiff, which was never even argued. And the funds weren't used commingled to pay Canada's obligations. In fact, all the money's going into Canada. In fact, if you look at that separately audited financial statement, you'll see the Diddy entities owed Canada $3 million in 1999. So what we have here is exactly what we had in Kelsey and Wallen, where the court said, quote, the opposite is true. Funds were constantly infused into Presto for the benefit of Presto. And essentially, we have a stipulation to that effect in this case. And even if the sale were not determinative, there's the question of whether it was an intentional scheme, which this court has required. And indeed, though IFF looks at the press release that was issued months and months earlier before anybody talked about selling this press, but even on that press release it says Canadian operations are separately located in Canada, which was a big point with the Illinois Appellate Court in Kelsey. The fact that you had that in your letterhead, your contract, and your invoices was enough to defeat the piercing claim. And as this court pointed out in bigger tone just last year when it reversed the jury verdict on a very similar fact situation, pointed out the contract disclosed the supposedly omitted facts. Here we have a machine order contract where the first page says you're buying this press from a division of City Web Press. And by the way, here's what Promus US is. It's down here in Florida. And here's an entirely separate corporation, Canada, which is up in Canada, which is only for Canadian operations. That was right on the front page of the contract.
They try to say that everything was as advertised, commingled, and it's the same company, and trade shows, and that sort of thing, same company.
Correct. It was one trade show, and it was months earlier. And what this court has pointed out is what you have to look at is what is happening at the time of the transaction. And it's clear the case here is really, was it intentional? And how could it be intentional if, as part of the scheme, you are literally sending out payment instructions by the hundreds to your customers, including this customer, saying, wait a minute, you know, if there's any confusion, Promus USA is the division of Diddy WebPress. Promus Canada is something separate. Don't send payments to Promus Canada that are supposed to go to the Promus USA division in Florida. And that was produced by the plaintiff in this case. So it would certainly be a self-defeating scheme to say, oh, well, we've merged everybody, so you should be able to rely on this, and at the same time be sending out contracts, letters, advertisements, and notices, all of which say, wait a minute, this Canadian corporation is a separate company located in Canada. And indeed, that's exactly what the Kelsey Axel and Brakes case stands for, which is, you might do this, but if the documents in issue show, and I think they said that was a Wisconsin corporation located in Wisconsin, then there can be no piercing. And what's more, to hold otherwise not only would make bad law, it'd make bad policy. You have a troubled company, and it's trying to salvage itself by selling assets and trying to get the best price. What in effect we would have is a situation where the purchaser is going in, not only looking at buying the liabilities, as Your Honor pointed out, on the company the subsidiary is purchasing, but now it's at risk at liabilities of all the affiliated corporations it's not purchasing. Therefore, how is the seller going to get a fair market price? And what's going to happen to the creditors down the line, because that company, like Diddy, is probably not going to survive if it can't maximize the assets in-house.
Well, you've argued this is an equitable transaction, an equitable decision about whether to pierce the corporate veil, and it went to a jury. We don't seem to have, if it's an advisory jury, we don't have a detailed decision by the district court.
That's correct.
Well, that's a first hurdle we're going to have to cover then. Or at least, unless we go right to the bottom line, which I guess you'd prefer we do on your
part. Well, and we can go to that. But just for the sake of a logical string, I'd just spend a couple of minutes,
right.
And your honors can tell me to move on if you like. But, you know, it's not enough. They would also have to show independently it was a sham corporation. And if you look at the capitalization, the formalities, and the commingling, you'll see that the Illinois courts have never allowed piercing under any facts that are like these. I mean, when a corporation has their own plants, they have bank accounts, they're paying everyone separate. I mean, Canada even has its own lawyers and accountants.
Were you saying that the jury verdict form was incomplete, didn't have enough questions on it in order for them to find to pierce a corporate veil?
Well, what we asked for in the jury instructions was an instruction that said you had to consider everything. And in fact, one of our points on appeal was that the district court said, no, I don't think so. Notwithstanding, there's two Illinois appellate court decisions that say that, and all the other ones do it in practice. He seemed to think that, well, if you can decide on one and it's sufficiently compelling, that should be good enough. And A, the Illinois appellate court say that's not the law, but B, that's one of the reasons why it's very difficult to give what amounts to a second-year law exam to some lay jurors and try and condense a dozen appellate court opinions into two double-spaced pages of instruction. It's just not a realistic thing to do, because the questions here aren't questions of fact. They're questions of law and policy. When Illinois courts decide these cases, they're basically saying it's the court that should be reluctant. And that's true. But you don't have that same check against jurors who don't have the ability to calculate what their decisions will do to the settled corporate law of the state of Illinois.
Well, of course, we also don't have the ability to review it because they didn't list the details. Because what you're saying, I'm sure the other side will challenge, say, well, that's not a fact, it was a sham, they did do the money, this, that, and the other thing. So there are a lot of fact questions that would have to be resolved. And for us to review them, we'd have to know how they were resolved, considered and resolved, right?
And I think that's why Illinois has that manifest weight of the evidence test in review, because this is kind of like almost like a First Amendment case in Illinois where they say, you know, we're going to scrutinize these trial decisions with a little bit of extra care in this context. And Your Honor puts a very good point. I mean, it's what we would have, at a minimum, liked to have seen, something below that we could have latched onto and said, okay, this is where it went wrong. We don't have that. In fact, we got a jury question which indicates that the jurors did decide to grasp only one point, the same point as they said, and we don't even know what point it was because everyone agreed when they looked at the question they were looking at the wrong page of the instructions.
Is there any indication that, was this Judge Corr?
Judge Corr.
Took this as an advisory jury and went ahead and made his own decision?
The only indication is that he said that he might do that. But one would have expected, had he done it, the judge would be conversant with the federal rules and would have issued the findings, which he didn't do. And since he denied the Rule 59 motion without any briefing or argument, and even before it was opposed, I tend to think that he was relying entirely on what the jury did. But I can't invade the mind of the district court at that point. I'm in rebuttal, but Your Honor wanted to talk about the jury question, so, you know, I will do it. It's clear that Illinois considers it to be an equitable issue. And this court has recently, like almost last year in Marseille Hydro Power, pointed out the reversal is required. So the real question, I think, is whether this is an equitable claim. And I was faxed over the Second Circuit opinion. I'm in kind of a disadvantage without the ability to study it at depth or brief it. But my view is this isn't the same type of case. This isn't a case where you're going after the shareholder of the defunct corporation. Canada never owned any shares, and neither did he or D. Webb Press. It was an asset. This is more like a constructive trust where you're trying to get over to an innocent beneficiary, and we know that is an equitable claim. So whatever it might be in certain circumstances, whether it's purely equitable or not, I think in this particular and relatively unique circumstance where you're almost trying to go up to the parent and then cross ways over to the former affiliate and subsidiary, it wouldn't fall in whatever the Second Circuit was doing. My only other observation on that is that they seem to believe that the Supreme Court opinion in Bangor Funta seems to carry no more weight than any other decision. I would say that the Supreme Court gave a very strong indication of Bangor Funta. This is a decision for courts and for courts acting in equity. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Dillon. Mr. Roeder?
Thank you, Your Honor. I may start. Stephen Roeder on behalf of International Financial Services Corporation. Let me start where, in part, Mr. Dunn started and where I think his argument errs. As an initial matter, the contract between Cronus and my client is not the Label Tech contract. The contract is attached as Exhibit 9 to the short appendix. It's a purchase order. It's a purchase order between Cronus, Webtron, and International Financial Services Corporation. References that other document that Mr. Dunn referred to, but that's the contract. Going backward from where Mr. Dunn argued that there would be no basis upon which you could maximize value. And getting back to the jury issues, of course there's a basis that you could sell assets without liabilities. It's called an asset sale. And when he argues that no one would buy assets of an ailing company if they were worried about the liabilities, you can always exclude the liabilities. You don't buy the stock. They bought the stock. And what they did is they bought the stock and all the liabilities that were associated with the ownership of that stock from the time that could have been from Diddy Corporation, etc., up to that point. That's what you do when you buy the stock. Now, what the jury was able to see, it was able to see the entire complexion, the entire tapestry of all the evidence of this, quote, Kromos Technologies merger. My client, Robert Seeds of IFSC, was on the stage in March of 1999 in McCormick Place when these three entities, Diddy Corporation, the Diddy Webtron division, and the Kromos Technologies Canada division were announced to the world as being one entity. It was a merger. They had cards, hats, golf balls, all sorts of promotional things. He was asked to be on the stage to lend credence to this idea that it is one company. There was no witness from Kromos who testified at the trial that rebutted the substantial evidence that the jury heard from Natasha Friedenberg about how this was supposed to be one entity, how the company was operated as one entity, how the president of Kromos Technologies, the company, the entity we find doesn't really exist, is also the president of Kromos Canada, is the senior vice president of the Webtron Florida operation, how he creates centers of excellence where individuals in Florida directly supervise individuals in Canada and vice versa, so all of the corporate reporting obligations are intertwined. There is nothing to rebut the testimony that there is sharing of losses. There is nothing to rebut the testimony that these nominally, apparently technically distinct corporations, that the fact that the merger did not occur was not disclosed to the organization. There's nothing to rebut the testimony that there were weekly cash flow meetings among all the different personnel, the controller of Canada, the controller of Florida, where they tried to figure out where the cash was going in the Kromos Technologies system. And there was nothing to rebut the evidence concerning this particular press and how it was, how Mr. Seeds was asked to finance it at the second trade show in the fall of 1999, when they're still rolling out the merger, still announcing a merger that they didn't happen, that did not actually happen, at a point where Kromos lets the world believe that this is a substantial enterprise, when in fact Florida is insolvent. Ms. Friedenberg again testified without contradiction, except a very bland statement by Mr. Anderson, the quote president of Kromos Technologies, that things are excellent in Florida. But Ms. Friedenberg says they're laying off people. Suppliers will not supply product to the Florida operation. We can't get our product out. And at that same point, thinking there's an entire Kromos Technologies entity, Mr. Seeds goes to the bank and borrows $950,000 and pays it for the construction of a one-of-a-kind, never-built-before press in Florida, which is really a variation of a Canadian press, a press that Kromos Canada produced. And there's nothing to suggest whatsoever that it rebutted the inference that in December of 1999, when they can't even make payroll in Florida, that the Canadian corporation requires the Florida operation to build a press to satisfy a Canadian liability. And when Natasha Friedenberg argues that why should we have to build this at a loss? Why should we have to do that? Francois Dallaire, the controller of Promus Canner says, don't worry, we're all one company anyway. You guys do that. So they're not even making payroll, or barely making payroll. But they have to assume an obligation that Promus Canada has. When push comes to shove, there's domination from Canada, makes Florida do this. In fact, Ms. Friedenberg, as the spring of 2000 came around, she had no space. The Promus Canada people were using the space in Florida.
So what you're saying is that he refers to as Canada, you call it Promus Canada, that's the company that was sold, right?
That's the company that was sold.
But their thing is they were shoving their obligations on these other companies?
We have the testimony, that's correct. We have a testimony that there was a press that Promus Canada originally built, the company, the customer did not want it. The Florida operation had to build a new press for that customer. Promus Canada did not reimburse that Florida company, so when push came to shove, if Promus Canada wanted it to happen, it happened. But all of this is in the context where they have a centralized computer system where one entity orders for the other, takes orders back and forth, they're sharing profits, and there is a commingling of lines of authority, of financial operations, and that is the entire then is a peculiarly fact-intensive question that the jury was entitled to consider.
Well, if we have to do that, does that mean we have to go through the whole record and find all these facts and then assume that the jury concluded that in order to come up with an affirmance?
Well, Your Honor, I think the court can just look, as it looks at any jury verdict, and that is to see whether there is a basis in the record in which a reasonable jury could have found.
But this is, maybe you're saying this isn't an equitable thing to pierce the corporate veil, then.
Your Honor, it's part equity, part legal. And the reason that...
Both of that would be a legal decision, then. I mean, the court's decision. Isn't it the court that's supposed to make the equitable determinations as well as the legal ones?
Your Honor, I think in this circumstance, it is a legal decision. And that was the point of, unfortunately, I did not see the case earlier, me sending around the Second Circuit's decision in the Patalacqua case. That we have so many decisions of this court, the Illinois Supreme Court, the Illinois Appellate Courts, that refer to corporate disregard issues being submitted to the jury. Judge Posner did when he sat by designation in the Torpor Oil case. The Illinois Supreme Court in the Main Bank case refers to issues of corporate disregard or alter ego being presented to the jury. All these decisions assume it's a jury question. The Patalacqua decision that I advised the court and counsel under 28J, the first one that I saw in preparation for the argument that explained why, even at common law, these were issues that were preserved to the jury as long as you sought a legal remedy, which is what we see, damages. Judge Dara, in a case that we cited, also indicated that these were decisions that were left, analogous decisions in the nature of creditors' bills, were left to the jury at common law. It is a legal decision, and that explains why Devin Blackmar have a jury instruction on alter ego. But unfortunately, we didn't cite the case early enough, but it is a legal decision. It's partly legal, partly equitable, and the Patalacqua case indicates why that is so. And I think Judge Kaur instinctively determined that when he noted on the record that they say it's equitable, but I find all these cases that say you send it to the jury. So I'm going to conclude that it is partly legal, partly equitable, and then he said it in response to in relation to one of Your Honor's inquiries earlier, Judge Kaur said, I'm going to treat it as an advisory jury to the extent that it's not. He did not enter specific findings of fact, but he said on the record, I'm going to submit it to the jury, and to the extent it's not, I'm going to consider it an advisory.
And it's not what?
It's not a purely legal question to submit it to the jury.
The extent it's equitable, he's going to treat it as advisory.
Right.
And since he had no findings, he must have said there's nothing equitable about it.
Your Honor, I don't know, and I wouldn't want to presume that. There are no findings. But if, to the extent that the court were to rule that it were simply an equitable issue, the Donbeck case, would suggest that the proper remedy then, if the court were to find that, would be to submit it back to Judge Kaur for findings of fact and whatever proceedings he thought would be appropriate. But I don't think we have to go there, because when you look at the substantial evidence in the record, there was evidence of domination, there's evidence of commingling of funds, and I'm referencing, as I argued to the court, from exhibit or instruction number 22, which is an instruction that Judge Kaur drafted, taking parts of our instruction, parts of Mr. Dunn's instruction. But there is evidence in the record of domination, commingling of funds, assets, or identities. They told the world they're the same entity. Undercapitalization, holding oneself out as being a unified enemy. They did not operate at arm's length. And they failed to comply with corporate formalities. They had interlocking lines of authority under the Centers of Excellence program. All of that is sufficient. There's evidence to support all of that, at least evidence that a jury could consider supporting at least more than two, which I think does not or would allow this court to affirm without having to send it back to Judge Kaur for further decision. Because this is a jury case. The jury was adequately instructed. The jury had more than sufficient evidence upon which it could have based that determination.
So go over again for me, beyond the commingling of the identities, what is it that the jury heard that would justify the piercing?
Sure. The domination, Your Honor. The Canadian press that Chromis Canada requires the Florida operation to build is a perfect example of domination. Right at the very point, the critical point, that the Florida operation is concerned it could even make payroll. That's why the evidence and record is pretty clear. They got to go to my client and be the bad guy and get another $174,000. At that very time, when by any stretch of a reasonable definition of insolvency, Florida is insolvent, Chromis Canada says, you build that press for us to satisfy our obligation. We don't have to pay you. And Francois Dallaire, the controller there, says, it's okay because we're all one entity anyway. That's in the record, unrebutted. So there's evidence of domination, evidence of mingling funds or assets, holding oneself solid as a unified entity. They didn't operate at arm's length. Each party would order and take orders for the other. All of these, there's sufficient evidence, and Mr. Dunn had more than an opportunity to present contrary evidence. In fact, he didn't on almost all of these issues. They didn't produce one witness to testify affirmatively that there was any kind of payment from Chromis Canada to Chromis Florida for that press, even though that was disclosed in discovery a year before trial. They had all of the opportunity to present these things. They didn't. And there's a sufficient basis in the record to support them. Not one, not two, but several. So you look at the instruction. The instruction lists the two prongs of the main bank test, the Van Doren test. Was there such a unity of interest and ownership that the separate corporate personalities no longer existed? The jury could have found that. And would adherence to the separate corporate existence sanction fraud or promote an injustice? The jury was able to find that too, and it did. It was more than sufficient evidence. The instruction was appropriate. It was a jury question, and that's why we think Judge Kaur was certainly within his rights to enter judgment on that verdict. So for all of those reasons, unless Your Honor...
Well, if this were to go back to Judge Kaur to make these findings that we don't have to review, what part would not be eligible for his review that would be confined to the jury? I know you probably say all of it, but
Your Honor,
you did say it's a combination of equity and legal.
Well, at least the Passalacqua case suggests that if you're trying to pierce a corporate veil and the relief that you're seeking is not essentially legal, then that ought not be presented to the jury. But here we want money. We want money because this was represented as one large entity, and it was the substantiality of that is in part of the fraud. And that's exactly what Judge Posner found in the Torco decision, that it was part of the fraud was leading the contracting party to believe that it was really dealing with a larger entity, a substantial enterprise, not one here that we later found out was insolvent in the state of Cass.
Now, the jury didn't find fraud, did it?
The jury did not find fraud.
Found it wasn't fraud.
Well, the elements of the fraud obviously have a higher standard of proof, and the elements, the fraudulent statements that we allege were different than the particular fraud involved, was just leading someone to believe that it was a higher standard, with respect to whether or not this was a larger enterprise. We allege fraud based upon statements that these funds were being used actually to fund the press. And so, even though the fact that it was a different cause of action, slightly different casting of the fraud, and certainly a higher standard of proof. So,
does it matter where the $7 million went in all this?
I don't think so, because all of that is post. $7 million transaction occurred in August of 2000, and in connection with that transaction, it was Cromis Canada's agent, Frank Laughlin, who asked our client not to sue so we wouldn't complicate that transaction, which is, in fact, even further evidence of what they understood could have been a commingling of assets and potential liability. That's when, and that's in the record, that's the statement in the yet another trade show. And Mr. Laughlin had drinks with Mr. Seeds in Rosemont and said there's a lot of bad stuff that went down and asked him not to sue.
Where's the purchaser in all this?
The purchaser,
the one that paid $7 million for Canada.
That purchaser, just like any other purchaser that buys stock, buys it with all the liabilities that attend to it.
So he's not a, it isn't a party, or?
It's not a party. AC&S with American Capital Strategies is the purchaser. It is not made a party. And we did not have a contractual relationship or any relationship with AC&S. Thank you, Your Honor. And for
Thanks
all those reasons, we'd ask for support to the
Thank you, Mr. Roeder. Mr. Dunn?
In answer to Your Honor's question with respect to what a jury might decide in this case, I think a jury could decide it was a breach of contract. I think that's clearly a legal issue. As Your Honor points out, it's what do you do with that? Fact, what's the policy of Illinois and how should be applied? And I think the concession that that's a legal question means that at a minimum the case would have to be remanded. Clearly, if the judge did, as the plaintiff contends, consider this to be an adversary or an advisory jury, he did not comply with the federal rule and enter his findings. And this court has repeatedly reversed for a failure to do that with respect to advisory juries. And even if we got past that, we'd still have to deal about the statutory right of the jury, because there never was a demand under Rule 38, and we did object to a jury in the initial pretrial conference, or at least sending our issues to a jury. I didn't hear anything that really answered the question of the $7 million. In fact, I think they conceded that the $7 million went in, and it was used for the benefit of the companies, and used for the benefit of the creditors, and that was all that was needed. With respect to the domination of the virtue of a press that was sold, there was a dealership relationship between these companies. They were paying the U.S. corporation to sell and market their presses, just like they were paying companies in Europe and in Asia to sell and market their presses. Diddy never got any money for those Europe and Asia sales, and Canada never got any money for the sales that Diddy made when it was selling its own presses anywhere in the world. It was all done by purchase orders, and the fact that they were fighting over this press doesn't show domination. It shows they were acting at arm's length between each other. If you look at those financials, you'll see that related parties owed Canada $3 million at the time. So clearly, there's a reason to say you might want to pick up the cost of this press
so
to offset what you owe it.
Something. It's an offset of an existing obligation?
Exactly. There's $3 million on the books that are owed based on commissions that haven't been paid back. And that's one of the things that's settled. I see I'm out of time, Your Honors, so I'll just conclude.
All right. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.